Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dane Cash, and as ever, I am here with Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo, how are you?
I am well today. Stoked off another fun weekend of racing.
Excellent. And you can be sure we're going to talk all about it. That's the name of the podcast, and we do what the name of the podcast is. Before we get into that, let me just tell you that all of this is made possible by Escape Collective. And if you haven't already, you should head on over to escapecollective.com/join and sign up, because I want to keep making these podcasts. And I think Cosmo wants to keep making these podcasts.
I do.
I want to keep writing race previews about Strade Bianche and all the other great things that are going on in the racing world. So yeah, head on over to escapecollective.com and sign up. We have a great show today, and we are going to talk about, obviously, Strade Bianche, the big one-day race that happened over the weekend. Is it a monument? I don't know. I mean, it's not, but we could talk about that or not. We're going to talk about the men's race. We're going to tell you how the men's race was won. We're going to talk a little bit about the women's race, give some of our, you know, takeaways, and we'll talk later in the week. We'll do a much bigger show on that and give you all the takeaways from the women's race. We'll also dive in a little bit to Paris-Nice and what's ahead there, as well as Tirreno Adriatico. So that's what's ahead in this show. All right, let's talk Strade Bianche. Let's talk Tadej Pogacar and Tom Squinch and Maxime Van Hills and how that race was won. It was quite a weekend for Tadej Pogacar, who won the bike race. Spoiler alert. Cosmo, we're going to talk about this men's race. We're going to tell people how the race was won. I think some of the Discord commenters pointed out that maybe this would be more of a how the race was lost or how somebody came in second, because that was maybe more interesting. But first, before we go into any of that, before we talk about that at all, what were your immediate takeaways from this race?
That I was right, that I saw this coming a mile away. but we talk about that later. No, I don't want to use that as a cudgel. This is what I expected to see from Tadej Pogacar. This is a course that really plays to his strengths, and he won his first race coming into the season last year on dirt and kind of a weird undulating race. And he did it again this year, just, you know, from 80K away, which is really impressive by any standard. But I think the course maybe made it easier for him than it needed to be.
There were some changes that were made to the course. We'll get to that in a bit. I will go maybe a step farther and say the bummer statement that I'm about to say, which is I was actually kind of bored. And I don't say that lightly, because I feel like it's kind of our job to make this stuff entertaining. It's all entertainment anyway, right? And yet I had a hard time being entertained with about half an hour to go. And that doesn't take away from Tadej Pogacar's brilliance, but I think the changes that were made to the course, maybe they may need to be rethought. I don't know. Let's get into it.
Yeah.
How was the race won? Can you tell us?
UAE refused to let anything go up the road. Apparently they chased down Tom Squinch, like a break with Tom Squinch in it, like 10K into the race. Apparently there was a move from like 30 to 40K that got brought back by UAE and EF. Like, they just really suffocated the race by the time the cameras turned on at what, 93K to go. There were three UAE guys at the front of the race. There was no break up the road. Quinn Simmons got a little bit of space and they got reeled back in. And then we came into Santa Maria, which is the sector of gravel where Tadej Pogacar said Tadej Pogacar is going to attack. And he attacked. And, you know, we can break down in details later, but basically nobody could go with him. And by the time they got off that sector of dirt, he had, I think, a minute or a minute and a half. They kept him a little bit close until they chased down the one rider between him and the group. And then Ineos was sort of like, hey, someone else should help. And no one else helped. And that, you know, they never came close to him. If you could even call the minute and a half close again for the rest of the race. So, yeah, very, very, very much over early. Very much a statement victory. I think a little bit more complex than people are giving it credit for. But yeah, I have no objection to the top line. Pogacar destroys everyone. Kind of boring in the end if all you were looking for was the first person to cross the line.
Well, I do want to break down. I do want to get to where you see the complexities here. I want to know. Yeah, I want the course. Cosmos view of those things. But before that, I will.
Oh,
we could take a break from all of that so that people can know that you really did call it. And, you know, I feel like if nobody is gonna toot their own horn, then their horn won't get tooted enough. So let's do it. Let's give people the knowledge that you, what was it, like 3 days before the race? It was pretty good.
Jared Gruber put up his usual brilliant photo set, just getting like, of course, Pogacar is in there clowning, like doing a little like Superman through the air. And I had commented like, yeah, it's great that they added extra kilometers so he can attack from either further out than he did last time. He attacked from almost the same spot, we should point out.
Right. But
30K earlier in this year's edition.
Right. Yeah, so that's the big change is that they added this extra loop and it added distance overall. It added gravel distance. And so even if he chose the same sector, attacked around the same area, he was still farther from the finish. So I think this week it is fair. It wasn't in the Discord comments, but I think it's fair for you to share the Caldit award this week, at least.
Yeah,
with Tadej Pogacar himself,
yes.
Who called his shot and told people exactly where he was going to attack. And I think there was a sense when watching this that it was, he was clowning, as you said. It was Tadej being Tadej.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. He's very like, you know, it was fun to watch him kind of like go from looking over his shoulder at the camera to doing a little thumbs up to, I think, maybe somebody he recognized in the crowd, to doing a high five with someone in his fan club up the final climb. Like, he wasn't ever showboating, but he definitely, and I kind of wonder, maybe this is part of the Tadej Pogacar game, is he does these little things that people can see on camera that suggest that he is, you know, totally having, you know, an easy time with this when he's actually riding as hard as he possibly can and just kind of throwing up these little clowning gestures to sort of throw people off and make them think it's easy.
I think it very much is. I don't know how calculated it is. I don't know how much he. I'm not saying that he's gonna before every race, like he's got a notebook and he's making plans, like how I will market myself and also how I will strike fear into my opponents. I'm not saying he's making notes, but I do think there is an element of consciousness to what he does that I find extremely impressive and effective. And I think we should talk about that when. I mean, let's just do it now. I mean, we should talk about the complexities of this race that might not show up immediately because he did attack from like 80K out and then was just off the front for 2 hours, basically. But yeah, first of all, what is it that you saw, you know, in the build up to the attack and then right after the move that make this more than just Tadej Pogacar being the best? I mean, what is it that led to this victory? How was the race won besides the fact that he is Tadej Pogacar and he's really good? Because clearly there's more to it.
Yeah. And, you know, I touched on a little bit of that. Was UAE was very, very willing to put all their chips on this square roulette tile. I don't know what metaphor I'm going for here. But they were completely like they were beating themselves up in a way that no other teams were willing to beat themselves up at this point in the race, right? And I think some of that played into the success of Pogacar's move because you did see, you know, between two sectors, UAE had kind of finished the sector that was in progress when the cameras came on. It's kind of rainstorm came in. Quinn Simmons goes off the front, and Ineos comes to the front of the field, maybe to keep Pidcock just out of trouble. It's on a paved descent, leads into the gravel section, and immediately UAE is right back to the front. And you could see a bunch of top contenders. You could see Squinch, you could see Pidcock, all these guys kind of like letting themselves drift back, kind of, you know, 15, 16 riders down from the front, because it's 80K, right? It's impossibly far. And the thing is, the way Santa Maria works, the way the topography is, you have kind of a steep climb and then a descent and then a steeper climb and a longer descent. So it's very hard for the group to stay together. So if you're in 16th position in the pack on the road, you're at the front, right? Or near the front. If you're at 16th and the pack is one and two wide with gaps on a gravel sector, you are 30 seconds behind the attack going. And, you know, no one really seemed too focused on making sure they were on Pogacar's wheel or responding distance from Pogacar during this interval. And, you know, part of that is it was a really big cold rainstorm. Like a lot of these guys maybe were thinking, I got to go back and get a jacket. There's 80K to go. I got to get food. I got to get hot tea. I got to do something. And Pogacar and UAE were clearly focused on like, let's ring this sucker out and launch him and see what happens. Yeah. Sepp Kuss really actually seemed to be the most like on it. He was definitely, if not following Pogacar intentionally, like making the moves that kept him right there. But when the attack went, he did respond. I just either couldn't get there or maybe was thinking, no, it's too far out. Maybe he was really focused on looking after other riders. Like Kuss is a great rider, Vuelta winner, but in a hilly one day, I think he's still kind of a super domestique, a top lieutenant. So it may have just been, you know, he didn't have full clearance to go after it. But the problem is you have this huge downhill of this like, you know, now kind of wet gravel roads that everyone else at least has to be aware of where other riders are around them. You know, they have to think, can I take this fast line or is this person going to come up inside me? Maybe I'll hit them. Pogacar had none of that. There was one motorcycle he kind of waved at to get it out of the way. And that was it. That was all he had to worry about, was pedaling fast and going in a straight line. And no one else in the field had that advantage. And Santa Maria goes on for like 10 kilometers. So there was a huge stretch of time where it was Pogacar time trialing to the best of his ability when there were probably still people in that main group kind of wondering what is going on in the race right now. Like Pogacar's off the front at, what is it, 10, 15 seconds? Like it's really tough, even with radios, with everything, to get that communication. And once you get it, if you are, you know, 30th or 40th in the pack, you're at the end of this peloton, which is a pretty small peloton by this time and point in time anyway, like you're kind of out of options, right? Like that ship has sailed. And so I think Trek really tried to get Simmons up the road to be ready for this sort of thing. Like Simmons is up the road by 30 seconds. We see Pidcock and Pogacar attack. Skoinch goes with them. Like they all meet up somewhere along the cobbles and then we have number advantage and we'll see who else can get across. And that just didn't happen. And that didn't happen because UAE really hammered the field and not everyone else was believing in this 80K move.
And you know, they also had the crashes, Simmons and
yes,
Skoinch both
that was
crashed.
Simmons kind of took Skoinch out.
Simmons crashed and then Skoinch crashed because Simmons crashed. Yeah.
It was a little like, I felt so bad for both of them, but especially for Tom's.
Yeah. And even all the more impressive to see Tom's do what he did. Yeah. Sorry, Skoinch. I, you know, we got to remain objective here. Last names only. Skoinch, do what he did with the blood coming out of his knee. Like when he finished the race and they like lay down on the pavement, like you could see it looked like it hurt. And the fact that he was able to do what he did and finish second, one of the best, maybe the best result of his career, having crashed pretty hard was very impressive. But let's go back to the period where Pogacar gets away. I think the peloton, or whatever you want to call the chase group, group two, there was an air of inevitability. As soon as he had maybe a minute and a half. And I think it's really important to point out that as incredible as Tadej Pogacar is, he's insanely talented. He may be the best all-around rider that I have seen in my time. His ability to do such a wide variety of things is just incredible. And he deserves all the credit for everything that he does because so much of it is a head game and he plays that well. All that said, I think it is, I don't think it's controversial, but I think it needs to be pointed out that actually, like, if 10 riders work together, they would be able to chase him down. Like, I think that's just kind of basic physics. And I'm not saying that's ever going to be something that we can rely on happening, but I think it needs to be pointed out that it's not that Tadej Pogacar is literally faster than a 10 rider coordinated group. It's that he knows with his aura of invincibility that that's not going to happen. Well, and they didn't really do that.
They didn't. And I agree with you. I want to put out a caveat there that like 10 riders, even 10 riders is too big a group to coordinate like a pace line on the gravel.
If they are 10 riders from different teams. And that's why I think with this specific race of this year's edition, had there been one or two other really big time contenders at the race, we might have seen one or two more teammates in that group who were a little bit more willing to wear themselves out for their leader. Because in the end, we got a pretty diverse group of teams. as opposed to four Visma riders, three of whom are all going to go all in, and maybe three little Trek riders. And if you have six people doing a pace line, I think you do. I think you can chase down Tadej Pogacar.
I still don't know if they could do a pace line on the dirt. It's
true with the terrain.
It's very I think people really undersell the undulation. Like, it is constantly up and down. There is a section after Santa Maria where there's a long stretch of road, and I think
they had
Maxime Van Hills. I think that's how you say it. He had slipped away into the gap, and Ineos actually chased pretty effectively, bringing him back. And then they just set up. And I understand why they set up. There's a lot of people in that group. Ineos was really the only one I could see doing, you know, coordinated effort. But again, shout out to Tim Wellens. Like, every time the lead Ineos guy turned around, he saw Tim Wellens. Like, right. they had Isaac Del Toro in that group too. I think they had another rider because Del Toro did a bike change at one point. They made it almost impossible to coordinate. I think Ben Healy, it was pretty isolated, so he did a lot of attacking, which is just no way to get people to coordinate. But what you really saw the gap go from like minute and a half to 3 minutes was this stretch after they had caught Van Hills, and just the rest of the group could not coordinate.
Yeah, I think that's, to me, all of these things are evidence that this is not a fitness test, that Tadej Pogacar is fitter than 10 people combined.
Yes.
And I do think that some people might have had that takeaway from this race. Like, it's a fitness test. I'm not saying that makes it any more exciting. I do think it was still kind of boring, and I wish that there had been more going on. Like, for me, the most exciting thing, obviously, yes, for the 9,000th time, we're biased. For me, the most exciting thing was watching Tom Squinch, like, surge to second place.
I'm going to follow up on that later, but okay.
Yeah, okay, all right. The fact is that Pogacar's incredible, you know, physical abilities were not the only thing that won the day. It's also his aura of invincibility, his tactics, his timing, and his team. I mean, his team did a lot to help, even though it might not be that obvious. So there's a lot more to this than just Tadej Pogacar is strong.
And that kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier with him saying, like, you know, everybody post-race interview is like, well, do you have a plan for today? And like, oh, you know, we'll see. You'll see it out there on the road. It's like, you know, people pay it close to the chest. They ask Pogacar, he's like, I'm going to attack on Santa Maria. Like, that is very much like, that's that, get that aura of inevitability out there, inflate it. Leonard Van Aert, they're interviewing him. And I mean, he had a good race, right? His teammate Van Hills was third. He had a pretty big role in that. But even he was like, you know, as soon as he went, like, they're like, no, we weren't surprised. And we are also not surprised that nobody could do anything about it. And I think that right there, like you say, is a huge part of why Pogacar is able to do this. It's not everything. It's still, you know, it's soft stuff. You can't put a power meter on how intimidated people are or, you know, how much they are willing to temper their expectations and race for second, which maybe this is a good opportunity to shout out the women's race.
Let's take that opportunity. What did you see at the women's race? We have Wheel Talk, which is going to discuss what's going to break down the women's race, which was a cracker of a race, as Brits like to say. Love that one. I thought that was, in terms of entertainment, I was far more entertained for far longer watching the women's race. The Wheel Talk podcast is going to break the women's race down. But what's sort of like the Cosmo takeaway? What's maybe the one big thing that you took away that we can leave with people?
You saw a lot of people racing to win. You saw people, I still think the Peloton has done another example of the Peloton doing a much better job of making S-Day Works do as much as they can. But at certain points, you saw Trek, you saw Phoenix de Kooning take over the race and shoot their shot. You saw Kristen Faulkner in the break where she could have very easily decided to battle for third and was like, hell no, I'm going for it. I'm going to, if Kassi's not pulling through, I'm going to try and get clear. I'm racing to win this thing. And we maybe didn't see that as much on the men's side.
Yeah, I mean, Abby Mickey wrote a story saying that Elisa Longo Borghini rode the perfect race, even if she didn't win. She did the perfect race for what she could have done. And I think they did what they could, and it's not always going to work. SD Works is still going to win a lot of the time. I think it was more enjoyable watching. Well, first of all, it was closer. I mean, it came down to that final climb. But it was more enjoyable when so many riders shot their shot, as you say. And for more on the women's race, Wheel Talk will be out in, I mean, I don't want to make any promises for Abby, but I, you know, she's I think going to get the file our way in about 24 hours. So you won't have long to wait for more on the women's race. Back to the men's race. What did you see in that battle for second that you wanted to come back to?
Going back to the weird bias in favor of Squinch. I feel like if somebody can have that kind of teammate crash at a super critical moment of the race, catch back up, have to fall off the back, get his bike changed, catch back up, miss another move, power across to that move, work with that move, come pretty close to getting dropped up the final climb, and then come around to take second place. Like, you should probably be a fan of that rider.
I agree.
It's hard to not be a little bit biased to overcoming that. And again, nothing against Van Hills. Like, he had a great race and was like, Lotto was probably the most aggressive team, at least in terms of not rolling over and racing for second. But you know, it's coming back from adversity is a compelling storyline. So
I totally agree. On the one hand, I would have been cool to see him dance and celebrate, which he has done before. On the other hand, I also like when people sort of acknowledge that they, you know, like, hey, second place Estrada is pretty sweet. Mm. And he did a little, just a very subtle thing at the finish line that I liked. To the point of Lotto being aggressive, I also feel like Lotto deserves a shout out. They are not a World Tour team. They got demoted. They got relegated. And I feel like since then, they have done a fine job of going out and getting young talent to establish that they are not just going to settle for being a second team, second tier team forever. And they've got Van Eetveld, they've got Van Hills, and they've got Arno Dalí.
Honestly, they're living their best life. Like, this is I am so much more stoked for not World Tour Lotto team than I am for World Tour Lotto team. World Tour Lotto team was like, not to pick on the French teams that really just seem to hang out and race anonymously in the Tour de France every year, but like, Lotto was not doing all that much. And I feel like they do a lot more now and it's a lot more interesting. And, you know, maybe it's in the Lotto Cycling Cup, you know, 1.1 road races in Belgium, but like, it's really interesting to see them throw down in these super scrappy, messy rain-a-thons and then bring that same scrappiness to a race like Strada Bianca. They're not like, wait, hold on. How do we get, we need some UCI points so we don't get relegated. Like,
right.
Hey,
yeah.
I see an opportunity. I'm going to go for it. Like, that's what good racing is. Right. And
what they're doing is getting them UCI points. Yeah. They're like a top 10 ranked team in terms of points right now, I think. So it's working. Good on Lotto. Some final thoughts from men's Strada. Who's your unheralded rider here? We talked about it. I know the answer. This is sort of cheating you know, we planned the show. I'm just setting you up to tell the listeners.
I'll say Tim Wellens. I think, you know, that teamwork is when a guy does what Pogačar does, it's hard to say, yeah, but his team helped. And I could tell you right now, yeah, his team helped. And they were super helpful. And Tim Wellens was, you know, I don't know if he is the most helpful. It's hard to really quantify that. But he was there in a couple of situations where things could have gone in a different direction and maybe they never would have, but he was there to make sure they didn't. And not, you know, again, the big story here is Pogačar smashing everybody, but yeah, you know, there's setup work behind the scenes.
I feel like Wellens is such a perfect rider to be unheralded because I think if you look at his career, he's had a hell of a career. He's done a lot of really, he's done so much. And yet I don't think he gets talked about as much as maybe most other riders with his level of talent might deserve. I mean, he's won the Eneco / Bink Bank / Renewy Tour, whatever the race is called, like three times. He's been an excellent teammate in the past at Lotto, and especially, you know, since coming to UAE, he's looked really good. And I'm just really happy to see him, well, getting heralded at least by the podcast of which I am you know, half the part, but I hopefully other people will start to herald him a little bit more too. Maybe another chance to give out some awards, some kudos. I'm gonna give out this week's agreeable commenter award because I agreed with the comment, and Cosmo and I were trying to figure out what to call it, and we couldn't come up with anything better. And, you know, we actually named an entire podcast after like our placeholder kind of name last year. And then we did it again because Pretty Serious Bike Racing was a placeholder name. And yeah, so we're going to go with a placeholder name for the Agreeable Commenter Award until we come up with something better. Andy, Jerry, I hope it's Jerry and not Gary, said what I was thinking to the letter when watching Strada Bianca and pointed out that watching Tadej Pogacar was, quote, like watching Annemiek, because very similar to Annemiek van Vleuten putting in some extremely long range attacks and then having nobody do anything about it. It ended up kind of being a experience that was somewhat familiar to me. It may not have been the most exciting, but I do think it's our job to point out why there's a lot more to it than it just being a fitness test. And hopefully we've done that. Last but not least, what's it all mean? I mean, what do we think this means for classics, for Pogacar moving forward?
Well, for classics, I think specifically for Strada, it means they need, if you're going to engage in this terrible discussion about whether or not Strada is a monument or needs to be a monument, which I feel is just a horrible waste of breath that everyone nonetheless is unable to avoid talking about. It's the Joe Flacco, is Joe Flacco elite of cycling? For those of you who don't follow normal sports, there is a professional football quarterback in the United States named Joe Flacco, who many years ago, decade plus ago, won a Super Bowl. And people were like, yeah, but is he elite? Is he an elite quarterback? And I'm like, he just won the context, Super Bowl.
Context being, he played for a Baltimore Ravens team with a fantastic defense. And, he was good. But was he elite? Was he elite?
And this discussion had to happen all the time. It really became a meme.
It had to happen.
And then this past fall had a pretty good season for an old dude.
Well, resurgence.
With the Browns. Anyway, it's like, is Strada a monument? Should Strada be a monument? It's like, it doesn't really matter. Like, if they make it long and the UCI gives it more points, then it's a monument. If they don't, they don't. But what they did was, and I like what they were thinking. They had kind of another loop around Cole Pinzuto and Latolfe. Did I say those correctly?
That's right. Yeah.
And that's
I only know this because I wrote a preview. It's
really cool because those two climbs are really close together. They're really close to Siena, to the city. So it's a good spot. Fans can get there and see the race multiple times. The problem is that you have Santa Maria is just such a launch pad. Like it's so big. It's so long. I think if you actually moved it kind of closer to the finish, maybe even closer than it has been in the past, you really kind of end up with a Roubaix situation where you're not expecting the peloton to come out of this, right? You're expecting maybe a dozen riders to be in contention after that sector. But I think having it where it is now is just too tempting. You're going to end up in situations where a strong rider can get space and a peloton that on paper should be able to chase them down can't do it because of the reasons we saw today. And I think if you cut everyone's legs off and it's just the heads of state, that would be very different than what we saw on Santa Maria this past weekend. Like you wouldn't have Tim Wellens leading out. You would have everybody glued to Pogacar's wheel, ready for it, keyed and ready. I think, if you want to do the monument thing, whatever. But like, I think they need to kind of refactor the course a little bit, get it to a situation where, that 80K is striking distance for more than one rider.
Yeah. I have a hard time disagreeing based on what we saw. Although it was one edition.
This is the third consecutive year where the eventual winner has separated themselves from the other.
With a huge attack.
With a huge attack on this sector of gravel. Like we had 2 years ago, Pogacar did it. And there were a bunch of other people attacking with him there at that moment. There was nobody this time, which I think should also be maybe reveal that this is not a great spot to have this particular sector. And then last year, Pidcock did it. Kind of on a descent. Like he was more responding to attacks and then got away on the descent and was like, okay, well, I have some space. I'll see if I can make these guys earn it back. And they really almost did like 7 times, but they never quite got him. Anyways.
All right. That's how Strada Bianca was won. Men's race, at least. And the women's race like we said, Lada Kopecky won the race. And we'll talk. We'll have a lot more on how it was done and what it all means. Let's go over the border into France a little bit here to cover some of the other things that are going on before we sign off for the day. Paris.
Geographically interesting segue there. I think it's Paris is.
I mean, but you go over the border and then several hours and you do get there, right?
I actually kind of wonder what the best line would be if it would be to go over the Alps. And I guess you have to go over the Alps no matter what. So,
I think that's true. And that's definitely what people are here listening to the podcast for. Paris-Nice, it's underway officially. Tirreno Adriatico gets underway on Monday. So, by the time you're listening, it should be underway. And we should talk a little bit about Paris-Nice and who's there, what's ahead, because placeholders has not really had a chance to do that. And, Tirreno is still coming up. So I think Paris-Nice is that we have a good opportunity from a time perspective to sneak in a little conversation about Paris-Nice here. Before we look ahead and before we talk about the GC riders of the race, let's talk about the first stage really quick, because I do think there was an interesting takeaway from this first stage. Well, interesting in that it's just another chance for me to get on a soapbox that I've been on quite often on the Pretty Serious Bike Racing podcast, on shows that you and I did in the past when we were not this specific podcast, but it was still just us talking about bike racing. And that is that when you get let out and then get dropped off at the front of a sprint a little too early, it's worse than not having a lead out at all. And Mads Pedersen came pretty darn close to winning anyway the first stage of Paris-Nice, when Jasper Stuyven did a heck of a job on an uphill run, almost getting him led out to where I think he should have pulled off, but still pulled off a little early, and Mads Pedersen still had to go a little bit long. And I think if anybody's going to go long, Pedersen can probably do it pretty well with his style. So it was close. And yet, Olav Koy managed to come around, take the win. Koy's a heck of a young talent, and yet another Visma rider that's going to be winning a lot of races here. It already is winning a lot of races. And I think he did a great job of just picking the right wheel there because, Jasper Stuyven did a really, really good job almost of dropping Pedersen off. So, a little too far from the line.
Do you know that you're too far from the line before you realize? It's one of those things where by the time you have evidence suggesting that you left it too long or you dropped him off too early, it's too late to do anything about that. Right?
Quantum
theory. You just have to use your best judgment. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think best judgment would imply that there is a risk that if you're more than 200 meters from the finish, that you're too early. I think that's probably a general statement that is probably generally true.
Okay.
And depending on the difficulty of the finish and how fatigued you are, you kind of move that line a little bit in either direction. Right. I think, in this case, proved to be a little too early. That's all there is to it. Olav Koy took the win. Pedersen took a very close second. I think we might see Pedersen back at it again quite soon. But for now, it's Koy 1, Pedersen 0 at the Paris-Nice sprints. And because we haven't seen, we talked about this on placeholders this week, where does the sprinting field stand at the moment? I think this is actually a pretty big marker compared to other races we've seen so far this year, that Olav Koy, you have to put him in that conversation right now for both speed and racecraft savvy. Let's talk about the field, though, and what's to come in this race. Mini preview, if you will, a bit of a recon ride on what is to come. We are going to see Primoz Roglic going head-to-head with Remco Evenepoel. Assuming they're both healthy and they don't crash. Those are your two big favorites. Egan Bernal also at this race, and I think I and many others are excited to see what he can do after he's been pretty good the last couple of weeks. Mateo Jorgensen is there. Go Americans. Also, Carlos Rodriguez has not gotten a lot of love from people despite finishing inside the top five at last year's Tour de France. And I think he's another rider that could be up there in that overall battle. And I think you're going to see a pretty close fight between Roglic and Evenepoel. And I'm pretty excited about it because they are, we think, going to be two big contenders at the upcoming tour. Insofar as anybody can be a contender,
I think they are the most entertaining to combine. Because Remco just seems just so extra all the time, sprinting yeah. for KOMs, like doing stuff almost just to do it. I feel like I can hear Roglic making these like irritated Eastern European sighs where it's like, like now I have to chase this idiot move that this idiot is doing. Like, why can't
veteran
we just wait?
Grumbling.
Yeah. Why can't we just wait to the big climb like normal yeah. bike racers? Why does he got to make it like it's a good pairing, I think, to kind of.
Yeah. I think we benefit as viewers.
Yeah. Zhuzh up an early season race.
As usual, Paris-Nice this year. Well, first of all, before I get to what I was going to say, as usual, there is a team time trial this week, unfortunately. then, as usual at Paris-Nice, the last two stages are quite hard. They tend to do that at this race. The seventh stage has an uphill, you know, what do you call those things? Oh, yeah, summit finish. There we go. That's the word I couldn't think of, despite having worked in this business for a little while. And then stage eight is just like up and down all day. And I think that the GC battle should be decided in those last 2 days. But yeah, lots to look forward to with the Evenepoel-Roglic battle there. I'm assuming we're going to talk about it more on placeholders. Meanwhile, over in Italy, because two World Tour races is better than one at any given time.
Especially if there are one-week stage races. The people used
yeah,
to tune
exactly.
up for Grand Tours. They definitely have them at the same time.
And we all agree that's a great thing to do. Tirreno will have the Jonas Vingegaard going for a stage race overall win storyline that we've all been waiting for. He looked basically unstoppable at El Gran Camino. I mean, not basically. He literally was unstoppable. He won of the three stages that were not neutralized from a GC perspective. He won three, and he won the overall. And he won the points jersey, and he won the mountains jersey. And he is back in action at the upcoming Tirreno Adriatico, which should be pretty exciting to watch. Should be. I'm looking at the field and like, I kind of think he should run away with this. Hopefully he won't from an entertainment perspective. Juan Ayuso for UAE will hopefully put up a fight. But yeah, I'm kind of, I'd be a little bit surprised if Vingegaard did not run away with it. Pidcock will be there as well, and we're expecting, or his team is expecting, that he's going to be a GC rider this year, so that could happen. But yeah, probably going to see Jonas Vingegaard destroy everybody. That's what I'm guessing. And that's what's coming up. And by the time we are back, well, I think we'll have lots to talk about because of all the racing that's coming up here.
I'm really curious. Thoughts? I'm really curious to see how Pidcock does. You know, it's one thing to pick off an Alpe d'Huez every now and then. It's another thing to, you know, do a GC, coming in saying you're doing GC. He did not look great at Tour de Suisse last year, and maybe that's because he kind of wasn't in with both feet on the whole GC stage race thing. So I'm curious to see what he does here.
Yeah, I wonder whether he will be in with both feet, given that he does still have some other things on his mind. Some other disciplines that he likes yeah. to dipping his feet in is even like, I don't even know if that really like he wins Olympic gold medals in those other disciplines. He dives in.
Right. Know? But he's saying in addition to that, he's doing this Tour de France thing.
Right.
So,
and I kind of, I mean, for a lot of reasons, I think it would actually really benefit the sport if he does turn out to be what Ineos wants him to be. I mean, for one thing, I think it would be cool if British fans had a exciting young rider that they could get behind as a, you know, possible GC contender at the Tour, which is pretty hard to do right now. Being, I mean, not that it's ever been easy to be a Tour de France contender, but right now with Jonas Vingegaard being as imperious as he is, and behind him with Tadej Pogacar being as good as he is, so it's a lot to ask for. But I think it would be pretty great for British fans, and I also think that it would be cool to see Ineos have a contender, but not be the sort of stifling presence that they used to be. We'll see. And Tirreno is an opportunity for him to show that he can maybe be that guy. We'll have a couple more though from him this year. All right. I think we've talked enough about how various races were won. Maybe won in the future.
In the process of being won.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been sufficiently serious so far. We can continue to be pretty serious a week from now. And in the meantime, the listeners will have a chance to catch Wheel Talk, Placeholders, Geek Warning. I know that I know Cosmo, we want to.
Well, you know, I mean, now, did you see that the UCI is investigating hookless rims now? Now it's real.
I did see that.
Now it's real. So go ahead, listen to Geek Warning. Hear them talk.
Yeah, they are talking about racing.
About the hookless rims.
So, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, lots to listen to in between now and the next time you hear from us. And you can expect to see all kinds of good stories over at escapecollective.com. In the meantime, we'll be back in a week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you then. Cosmo, what's your name, and what was the name of this podcast?
I'm Cosmo Catalano, and that's how the race was won.